You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, January 7th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, from Mother Jones, Kevin Drum, on the fascinating evidence that the massive reduction in crime that we saw in the early 1990s was not a function of stop and frisk or broken windows or Rudy Giuliani just having a tremendous amount of charisma, but was in fact a function of the abatement and reduction of lead in our atmosphere. Also on the program today, Chuck Hagel may be our next Secretary of Defense. Meanwhile, our next head of CIA, the torturer. Wonderful. And I should also say, to be fair, also an assassin of sorts. Also on the program today, Dick Armey, more and more about FreedomWorks. We're in line to get some of that FreedomWorks payola. We'll be talking about our Tea Party events coming up later in the program. And Social Security attacked in a novel attack. We will discuss Mayor Bloomberg. Teachers unions, just like the NRA, except for that whole thing about producing stuff that kills people. All that and more. But first, ladies and gentlemen, with us now, we're going to get a little meta. With us now, on the phone from Las Vegas, is our very own Matt, who is sent down there, hopefully, to collect a podcast award for us at some new media convention, but who knows what's going to end up. What is going to... Matt, are you there?
Hey, Sam. Hello, everybody. How are you all doing?
Well, I don't know how they're all doing. They can't hear. They can't respond to you. But so, Matt...
Well, I'm directing that question to you and Michael.
Well, Michael's a wreck. He's nervous about doing the tech board without...
False. I'm doing great. I'm calm and in control.
That's pretty funny.
All right. So... we just have a minute here. We're getting a little meta. You are at the New Media Expo, is that right?
Yes, the New Media Expo, yes.
And are we the bell of the ball there, or what?
Well, the podcast awards are tonight, and that's when hopefully we will be.
All right.
But, I mean, right now I'm outside of the convention hall where Guy Kawasaki, the former marketing director for Apple, is talking. And Bush and Cheney will be very happy because, well, maybe not for the reason that Bush and Cheney disliked Apple, but he was just railing pretty hard against Apple. So that should make him very happy.
Oh, that's good.
That a former Apple guy, yeah. And then I'm going to watch Dana White from UFC. And then from there, just whatever until the podcast awards.
Well, and I hope you're wearing a nice suit because when they call you up to get the best political podcast or the People's Choice, I hope you are representing us well. It's not Casual Friday, and you know what that means.
Well, every day is Casual Friday for me.
Well, okay, great.
I will be first.
Where they put you up?
They put in the Rio. It's a very nice room, actually. They gave me a very nice room.
Well, all right, great.
So I'm right off the strip in Vegas. So now, it's pretty good. It's pretty nice.
When we all got together in the office and said, let's send Matt, I thought that you had never been west of the Mississippi, and apparently you haven't, except for one trip once to Las Vegas.
Yes, unfortunately for you, yes. But this is my first trip by myself. How about that?
There you go.
That's something, right?
Without mommy and daddy.
Or the girlfriend.
Or a girlfriend.
So, yes.
You know what I'm noticing here? Matt sounds a little Taibbi-ish on the air. Do you notice that a little bit? Sounds a little bit like Matt Taibbi.
Well, all right. I mean, interesting. I didn't pick that up. But and have you done any gambling?
I have not, actually. I got in the flight coming in last night. It was pretty late.
So you're aware that the tables are open all night, right?
I was very tired. there was very much a lot of turbulence on the flight from North Carolina to Vegas. So, interesting story. Really? While I was at the Charlotte, North Carolina airport, I unfortunately missed it. But the exact same time I was there, Ron Paul's grandson was arrested at the airport.
Ah, wow! There you go.
I'm very, very disappointed that I missed that. That would have been fun to watch.
And you didn't, I assume you didn't bring your loaded handgun on the flight, did you?
No. Maybe that's what he did.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess we'll find out. All right, well, Matt, we will await to hear from you tomorrow when we find out whether or not we won. It's going to be really depressing, and if you you went all the way down there and don't bring back a huge trophy for us.
Maybe depressing for you, but I am here, so it would be okay with me.
All right. Well, you're quite a team player. All right, Matt. Thanks so much for checking in with us.
All right, and thank you for choosing to send me down here to represent the Majority Report.
Well, all right, Matt. Good luck. We'll talk to you later.
Bye.
All right, folks. We will be back in just a moment. We'll be back in just a moment with Kevin Drum. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program from Mother Jones, Kevin Drum. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
This story that you've written, I mean, it's been around. I've seen, you know, sort of brief mentions of it through the years, and I don't know that anybody's really done such a deep dive into this. And this is, and that's actually part of the story too. But you start off talking about what America's real criminal element is, and give us a little bit of the backdrop on the narrative that has existed really for the past 20 years as to why crime rates dropped so significantly in the early 90s.
Yeah, it came as a big surprise to everybody. You know, for 30 years from the 60s through the 80s, we had a huge crime wave in America. Crime rates doubled, tripled. And then they suddenly started dropping in the 90s, and nobody predicted this. Nobody thought it was going to keep up, and they just kept dropping and dropping, and they've been dropping ever since. And so what happened was, you know, some people started looking for alternate explanations, you know, beyond the ones that we usually hear. And, you know, we've known for a long time that lead is bad for kids, right? We know that it lowers IQs, it causes learning disabilities, things like that. But over the last 10 years, there's been sort of a second thread of research that shows that lead does a lot more than that to children. It affects areas of the prefrontal cortex, It affects what are called executive functions, and those are the ones that help you keep control of your emotions. They do impulse control. They affect your judgment, sort of all the things that sort of keep you from being violent, from going out and doing stupid things. And it turns out that, you know, we now have a substantial body of evidence that children who are exposed to, you know, even moderate levels of lead when they're young, and we're talking about, you know, from ages 0 to 5 primarily, if they're exposed to lead at that age, it affects their brain development in a way that sort of artificially makes them more violent when they grow up. And
we should say, I want to just stop here for a moment, because when we say that we've been aware of this for years, I mean, we've been aware of this, at least in some form or another, it seems to me, for almost 100 years now.
Well, we've been aware of different things about lead. 100 years ago, we knew that lead was bad for you in very high doses. So, I mean, if you worked at a lead mining factory, or if you worked in a factory that made lead paint and you got huge doses of lead, yeah, the effects of that level of lead ingestion were pretty well known.
Or if you worked at those companies that were set up back in the day to make engines more efficient and less knocky and pingy, and you were developing this tetraethyl lead, there was all sorts of problems with those workers.
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, you know, that's the real story here about lead. It's about gasoline lead. When you're talking about crime, and that's what I'm talking about in my story, you're talking about gasoline lead. You're talking about this additive, as you said, called tetraethyl lead, which was invented by General Motors in the 1920s to keep engines from knocking. Ironically, the guy who invented tetraethyl lead, Thomas Midgley, died of lead poisoning eventually. Mm. So this stuff was put on our engines, and after World War II, you know, we all went on a car buying binge, right? We bought millions of cars, filled them all up with leaded gasoline, and we spent decades spewing lead into the atmosphere. And that lead was ingested by our children. It settles down into the soil, into the dust. It's in the atmosphere. Our children ingested it, and then it affected their brain development. And what happens is you wait, you know, 20 years. You have to wait for the kids to grow up. So by the mid-60s, we had this generation of sort of artificially violent kids who had grown up. And so starting in the mid-60s through the 70s and 80s, we had a huge crime wave. And you know, one thing to keep in mind, this is a huge crime wave over and above sort of what I'd call kind of the natural baseline of crime, right? You've got sort of a natural baseline that's affected by culture, by race, by poverty, by drugs, by guns, by policing tactics, all those things that we know about. This is over and above that. It was a huge increase. Well, then in 1975, we started to ban lead in gasoline. It happened slowly, and by 1995, it was completely gone. And what happens is, after 1975, there was less lead around. Kids started growing up more normally, and by the time they started growing up in the early 90s, they were less artificially violent. And so starting in the early 90s, crime rates, violent crime rates, started to go down, and they kept going down and down and down as this generation of kids grew up. Today, crime rates in big cities are, in practically every big city in the country, it's down at least 50%. In places like New York and Los Angeles, it's down 70 to 80% from its peak.
I mean, this is just stunning. Now, the story that we were told really over the past 20 years. I mean, obviously, you know, you basically tell the story, and I want you to go through that about how this has been examined through the years. But the story that we were told at the time was that it was about broken windows, which was this theory on crime that if you attack the small things, then you will eliminate the bigger instances of crime. And in other words, if there's a broken window in a house, it will invite other people to, I guess, break other windows. And this was sort of the narrative that was going on. Talk to us about that and the other theories that have been sort of promulgated over the years.
Sure. You know, broken windows was a theory that that was put forth in the early 80s, and then in 1995, when Rudy Giuliani became mayor of New York, and he hired Bill Bratton as the police commissioner, and he implemented this thing called broken windows. And you're right, the theory there is, you know, if you let the small stuff go, then it will start to spiral. People will see that the neighborhood is going downhill, and you'll eventually get bigger and bigger and bigger crimes. So the theory was, you know, cut down on the small stuff, the panhandlers, the squeegee men, the turnstile jumpers, that sort of thing, and you'll start to see an effect. Now, there's a lot of controversy in the criminology community about whether broken windows works. You know, my own sense is that it's probably effective. It probably does have some benefits. But you got to look around. You know, crime in New York peaked in 1991. It started going down in 1991. That's 4 years before Giuliani and Bratton got there. And plus, you can look at other cities.
Do you think it's not possible that people sensed in some way that Giuliani was coming and just decided to give up a life of crime?
Well, I wouldn't put too much money on that. But crime went down in Baltimore. It went down in Atlanta. It went down in San Diego and Los Angeles and Chicago. There was no broken windows in those cities in the 90s. Nobody was doing that in those cities in the 90s. It went down in cities in Canada. It went down in cities in Europe. I mean, crime went down all over the world, regardless of what kind of policing tactics were used. So, you know, broken windows probably was kind of a little bit of a tailwind that helped. But I think the big reason the crime started to decline was probably not broken windows. It was probably mostly because of the decrease in lead.
And so talk to us about a couple of the different studies that sort of tested this, because, you know, it is really an amazingly stunning phenomena if this turns out to be the case. And you really rigorously go through the different sort of studies that addressed, I mean, because, you know, there's obviously a difference between causation and correlation. And you go through a bunch of the studies. Talk to us about a couple of those that sort
right. There's basically sort of three main lines of investigation. So the first one you just sort of mentioned, these are what are called ecological studies. They're statistical correlations, right? You take a look at crime rates and you see a curve. Then you take a look at lead emission rates and you see a curve. The curves match up. Now, as you say, correlation is not causation, but that's suggestive that there's something going on. So then you take a look, for example, one study took a look at crime rates in different states. Right? It turns out that different states adopted unleaded gasoline at different rates. So your prediction would be, look, the faster they got rid of the lead, the faster crime would go down. Well, that turned out to be exactly right. The more lead they got out, the faster their crime rate went down. You can take a look at that at the city level. You can take a look at it at the country level. Different countries got rid of lead at different times. Their crime rates started to fall at different times. So now, these are all statistical studies. Okay, so that's one line. Then there's a second line, which is what you call a longitudinal study. At the University of Cincinnati, they've been following a group of kids. This is just one of them. They've been following a group of kids for the last 30-plus years, 400 kids. Every 6 months, they came in. They measured the lead levels in their blood. They tested them how they were doing in school and all that. And what they found was the higher the level of lead in their blood, you know, at age 5, they were doing worse in school. At age 15, they were getting into juvenile delinquency. At age 25, their arrest rates for violent crimes were higher. It just popped out. It was clear as a bell. The more lead they were exposed to, the more likely they were to turn into criminals later in life. And then there's finally, just recently, and this is just in the last five years, really, there's been a third line, which is MRI studies of the brain. So, for example, you can take these kids, who are now adults, of course, but who were exposed to a lot of lead in their childhood, and you can take a look at their brains and see how they develop differently. And I mentioned this earlier. It turns out that if you're exposed to lead as a child, your brain your brain development is permanently affected and affects areas of the brain in the prefrontal cortex that are all about impulse control, emotional regulation, judgment, ability to pay attention to things, stuff like that. All the kinds of things that you would think if they're degraded, you're more likely to become a violent person.
You know, one thing that really also fascinated me is you talk about Carl Smith's rule of thumb for categorizing epidemics, because, you know, I mean, I think that the lesson that we could be learning, I mean, from this story of lead is one that could change both in terms of the way that we look at criminology, and we'll talk about why sort of that social studies has been so slow to adopt or understand or even become aware of these other studies, but also the implications for other situations that we have in society. But this part was really fascinating to me when you talk about this sort of the differences, or he talks about the differences in microbial insects and molecules. Right. Just walk through that for us.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a very short thing. Is if you look at people often kind of compare crime to an epidemic, and for kind of obvious reasons. But if you take a look at a real epidemic, you expect to see it progress in some way, right? So if you think of, say, the bubonic plague in the Middle Ages, right? I mean, you've got a rat that comes off a ship in Venice, and then the plague spreads. I mean, it spreads from Italy to France up to Germany and into Scandinavia. You can see it spread year by year. Now, if you see it spread like that, you figure there's got to be a carrier, right? In the case of the plague, there's the carrier is a virus. But in the case of crime, in the case of the big crime wave starting in the 60s, it didn't spread. It didn't spread from city to city, from country to country. What happened was all over the country, all over the world, really, crime rates skyrocketed. I mean, it happened all at once everywhere. You know, that's right. I mean, that's obviously not going to be a virus, and nobody ever thought it was. But it's also, if you take a look at sociological explanations, it gets really, really hard to blame it on something when it's happening everywhere all at once. You can, you know, if it's in America, you could, you know, if you want to blame it on race riots or, you know, racial factors in the 60s, maybe you can do that. But how does that explain Canada? How does that explain Britain and Germany and France? It gets really hard. So you need to look for something that could have happened everywhere in the world all at once, and lead really fits the bill.
It's absolutely fascinating, and talk to us about what's also sort of fascinating, what's also sort of an amazing lesson from this. And again, I guess, you know, I don't know if we'll ever know the absolute, you know, for 100% certainty that but it seems to me we're pretty close here that. There's nothing in criminology. I mean, this hasn't been addressed by really any of the people who deal with crime in any way.
No, not really seriously. One of the reasons I wrote this piece, and you mentioned this at the beginning of the segment, was that this has been written about before. There have been newspaper articles here and there. There have been a few pieces here and there. But there really hasn't been a kind of a big long-form examination that really sets out, you know, the whole case, all the evidence all at once. And I really felt like it was time to do that because, you know, 10 years ago, I would have said that this was sort of an intriguing idea, worth further study. But now, I mean, the evidence has really been piling up. It's been piling up a lot. And by now, I think there's a very, very strong case for the effects of lead on violent crime. So I thought it was worth doing a really long, deep dive into that. And one of the reasons I wanted to do it was because I don't think the criminology community has taken this seriously, and I think they should. Even if what they want to do is go in and debunk it because they don't like the theory, that's fine. But I would just like to see them do the serious, rigorous work to really take a look at lead, compare it to other theories of crime reduction, and see how they hold up.
In the course of writing this piece, I mean, did you have conversations with people in those various fields that deal with crime and get a sense of as to why they, you know, what the different reasons were that they haven't really taken this seriously or been aware of it?
Well, yes and no. I did have some conversations, but the truth is I never really got a good sense of why, because for the most part, they just hadn't even considered it. It just wasn't on their radar. I mean, there were a few who had kind of heard of it, but that was about it. And you know, when I talk to the, you know, in the magazine article, I quote a bunch of people who have done these lead studies, and every single one of them, I ask them, you know, did anybody from the criminology community ever engage with your study? I mean, did you ever hear from them? And every single one of them said no. I mean, you know, it was of interest to public health experts, but the criminology community simply never even really contacted them. Never, you know, didn't write to say that they were wrong. they just didn't engage with it at all. And I think it's well past time to do that. You know, one thing, you know, one motivation for this, and I think is something that everybody should keep in mind, is that when crime, I mentioned this, when crime started to drop in the 90s, nobody thought it was going to keep dropping. It took everybody, literally, it took everybody by surprise. You know, in the mid-90s, if you remember this, there was actually a big scare. There was going to be, you know, the children of the baby boomers. There was a sort of echo of the baby boom, and there was just going to be this demographic bulge of young males who were coming of age in the middle 90s. And there was this idea that it was that we were going to have a whole generation of what were called juvenile super predators. Crime was going to get worse and worse. And it didn't. Crime went down and down and down. Every single theory at the time, every single criminologist was shocked that crime continued to go down, and they really had no explanation for it.
Do you think it's just that you have two different fields that are so diverse that divergent that it didn't occur to them, or is that, I mean, are we looking at one of those sort of classic cases of there's, you know, when you're a hammer, everything's a nail, and you have a certain right. amount of, you know, if I've invested my life and or my legacy is invested as a public official in having been responsible for diminishing crime, I would imagine there's a far less tendency to go out and find an answer that actually says, nah, not so much.
I have to sort of guess a little bit, but I think there's a few reasons. One is, you know, up until about 10 years ago, I mean, 10 years ago, you know, the evidence for this really was kind of new and fairly thin. I mean, I don't blame anybody for not just jumping right on the bandwagon 10 years ago. I think today there's much more evidence, and I think the criminology community has really not caught up to the latest, you know, to the latest body of evidence on this. So that's one thing. The other is, yeah, I think, you know, criminologists tend to be sociologists. I think they look for sociological explanations of things. You know, they've kind of built their careers on this. And so it takes a while for them to come around to the idea that there might be some other completely different explanation that really, has nothing to do with all the stuff they've studied for years. And on a, you know, on a public policy angle, you know, it's kind of a unfortunate thing, but there's no, you know, a lot of our crime policy is driven by interest groups, right? And so you've got interest groups who are interested in different theories. So, you know, if you're a prison guard, you like the idea that putting more people in prison causes crime to go down. Mm-hmm. If you're a drug warrior, you like the idea that it's drugs. If you're a gun control advocate, you like the idea that it's guns, right? So you've got interest groups who are interested in pushing all these other ideas. If it turns out that a big part of the reason is lead, it actually kind of takes away from, you know, the arguments that all these other people have, and it takes away from their ability to get money for their pet projects. And, you know, that's tough. I mean, a lot of these projects are worthwhile things, too. I mean, they really are. And yet, like it or not, I think the evidence today suggests that all of these things, although they matter, I think they probably matter less than we ever thought they did.
All right, so let's jump off from this story. Step back from it a little bit and talk about it seems to me that there are tremendous implications to this story. If it becomes if there becomes wide acceptance that this was the cause of this this spike in crime and the ultimate sort of diminishment, I guess, of its presence of lead in our atmosphere because the EPA finally stepped in and said, we're going to do this. I mean, at one point, I think New York State back in, I think, the 60s or had actually regulated the emissions of lead and then were sort of forced to reverse it basically because of the lobby involved with, you know, DuPont and Standard Oil and GM, who were all partners in developing this lead additive. What are the implications here for things like other emissions that we put into the atmosphere? What are the implications, the racial implications here? I mean, you know, we're sold this notion in New York City that stop and frisk is that you need to stop, you know, you need to stop every black male who's age 17 walking around, you know, every two or three times a year to make sure that there's no crime. And what are the implications for this?
Well, there are racial implications. You know, I mean, everybody reacts to lead. Every brain reacts to lead the same way. But what does matter is the concentration of lead, right? More lead is worse. Well, where do you have more lead? You have it in places that have a dense concentration of automobiles. At least, I mean, you did back in the 60s and 70s. Places with a dense concentration of automobiles, where is that? It's the inner core of big cities, which are disproportionately African-American. So it's true that there is a racial side to this, which is that at the time this was happening, it affected African Americans more than it did whites. And that probably did lead in some ways to, you know, to fear of black crime at the time, which has now largely gone away. Not entirely, but it's largely gone away. But we haven't really caught up to that yet. So there are racial implications. There are implications for big cities versus small cities. Most people don't know this, but, you know, crime rates in big cities used to be way higher than in small cities, and we all just sort of took that as a kind of a law of nature. Big cities are dangerous places. But now that lead emissions have gone down, turns out that, you know, the crime rate in New York City is only a little bit higher than it is in you know, small cities around America. Big cities are a little bit more dangerous than small cities, but only a little bit. So there's a lot of implications. Now, you know, there's one thing that we can take away from this also, and that is that, you know, lead is a very, you know, it's a very common story. And, you know, it's one that we've heard over and over, and that is, you know, something is out there. We have industry flax who spend decades telling us that it's not dangerous. And, you know, as more and more research gets done, we find out that it is dangerous. And what's more, we find out that it's dangerous in lower and lower and lower doses. You know, it used to be, you know, lead in the blood is measured in what's called micrograms per deciliter. And it used to be that we thought the highest safe level was 40, and then it was 30, and then it was 20, and then it was 10. Now it's, you know, now it's 5 at the most, and you know, the best science we have now says really it's 0. I mean, there is literally no safe level of lead in the bloodstream. And the worst effects are at the lowest levels. You lose more IQ points going from 0 to 10 than you do going from 10 to 20. Hmm. It's just really damaging stuff.
And to what extent did lead remediation in terms of paint and in old apartments? I mean, when I had moved back to the city a while back, my daughter was about 3. We got a great deal on an apartment. We went in there. It was gooped up with paint quite a bit, and we just my wife, bless her for this, said, we got to get this lead checked. The guy came in and was just like using his machine against the wall and swabbing the floors. And he's like, this is bad. This is really bad. And I said, would you have your kid in here? And he goes, not unless I didn't have any other option whatsoever. And, you know, in our case, we had another option. We just said, to hell with it. We're going to find another apartment. If it means we got to pay a little bit more, we'll do it. I imagine for the vast majority of people, they don't have that option. They also probably don't have the awareness that that's something that they should even check at this point, because I think there's a perception that there's no lead out there. I mean, this guy told me, he said, you know, we don't wear shoes in my apartment because there's lead out there on the ground, and you bring it in on your feet, and it just gets into the cracks of the, you know, the lead dust gets into the cracks of the wood and whatnot. And
that's exactly right. There's, you know, one reason that we haven't done very much about lead in the last 20 years is because everybody thinks we cleaned it up, right? I mean, lead paint was banned 30 years ago. Leaded gasoline was banned in 1995. But, you know, there's two things. One is there is still lots of old lead paint around. And, you know, it's not kids eating lead paint chips. That's not really the main way that kids get lead poisoning. What it is dust. The biggest culprit is in window frames. So you've got, because there's a lot of friction surfaces there, right? You open and close the window a lot, and that breaks off the lead, and you get lead dust from the window frames. So that's one area. So old paint and old housing stock. The other is in soil. You know, we spent 50 years spewing lead out of our tailpipes, and all that lead has to go somewhere, and where it went was into our soil. So especially in big cities, you have pretty high concentrations of lead in the soil, and of course, you know, that's where kids go out and play, right? They go to the playground, they go to school, they play, you know, their hands get into the dirt and they lick it off their hands. And that's how they get lead in their system, is by licking their hands after they get dust on them. And so those are the two areas that we ought to be paying the biggest attention to. We ought to be cleaning up the last of the lead paint in our housing stock, and we ought to be cleaning up the soil, especially in the worst hit big cities. We should do a soil survey of every big city in the country, map out the worst areas of lead concentration in the soil, and we should be cleaning up the worst hit neighborhoods.
Now, you talk about this being, you know, this is somewhere around, you know, you did the numbers a little bit. You could be talking about $20 billion a year, but the return on investment is huge.
Right. And you know, the next step, that was, you know, the numbers that I had in the article, that was kind of my best guess. And it was based on the best evidence I could find. But the truth is, the best evidence I could find isn't very good, because nobody's done a really rigorous cost-benefit analysis of this. That would be the next step. You know, somebody like, you know, Congress should, say, commission a National Academy of Sciences report. You know, get some real scientists out there, spend some time, do a really rigorous analysis of where the lead is, what the cost-benefit is. It wouldn't cost very much to take at least that first step. But we should find out where the lead is. We should really get a good idea of how much it would cost to clean it up and what the benefits would be of cleaning it up. I'm quite certain that if we did that, yeah, the benefits would be way, way higher than the costs.
Now, I don't know how much familiarity you have with the development of this lead additive, and if it's not something that's in your portfolio, as it were. But my understanding is that there were substitutes that could have been used instead of lead, but they weren't patentable. That in many respects, I mean, you mentioned the tobacco industry as a sort of a model for this, but to a certain extent, I mean, this is an age-old example of large corporations essentially imposing these externalities on society in a way that it seems to me almost impossible at this point to calculate just how, I mean, the you know, and I don't know if, you know, there's some trial lawyers looking at this and going, hey, wait a second, because society has paid an enormous price so that these corporations, and there is quite a bit of evidence, it seems to me, that they were aware of the implications of lead, an enormous price so that they could have a patentable product to put into their, whether it was their gasoline or into their cars, ultimately.
Well, I don't know whether there's a legal case or not, but yeah, there's no question. They, you know, the reason they got away with it was because they would do, you know, it was a typical thing, and you're right. It's similar to the way the cigarette industry worked, and of course still works. You know, they did their own corporate, you know, their own industry-sponsored studies, and of course they always found that lead didn't have a big effect. And, you know, they did this by testing on adults, for one thing. And, of course, you know, the big effect of lead is on children. Adults aren't usually in big danger except at very high levels of lead. At lower levels, it's children. So you do your testing on adults, you don't find much of anything. Even if you do test on children, you know, it's something where you have to wait 10, 15, 20 years to really see the effects. So you go and you do your study, and you come back a year later and say, well, the kids don't seem to be affected, so there's no problem. And, you know, you keep doing this year after year after year. And it took until, you know, maybe starting a little bit in the 60s, and it really took off in the 70s, where some, you know, independent researchers really started looking initially at the link between lead and IQ and how kids did in school. And it wasn't until the 60s and then really into the 70s that you really got that independent research showing how bad lead was for you. And it was at that point that the EPA started to really crack down on lead. And, you know, honestly, we also got kind of lucky. We were fighting smog at the time, right? And to fight smog, we put catalytic converters on cars. And catalytic converters won't run with leaded gasoline. So we had to get rid of lead and gasoline in order to run cars with catalytic converters. But that was because we were fighting smog, not really because we were fighting lead. So there was sort of a lucky byproduct of the fight against smog.
So this is one of those stories that we often hear about, the unintended consequences of government policy. And in this instance, it has saved literally now a couple of generations of millions of kids, and as well as society as a whole.
Oh yeah, you know the cost of removing lead from gasoline was tiny, right? I mean, by the time we did it, engines no longer needed lead. I mean, GM and Ford were all had developed engines that would run fine on unleaded gasoline. So the cost of removing lead from gasoline was just minuscule. It was tiny, and the benefits have been incalculable. I mean, in IQ, in lost earnings, in reduction of violent crime, trillions of dollars, literally trillions of dollars, for a program that probably costs no more than maybe a small number of billions of dollars. It's quite possibly the highest cost benefit, sort of accidentally, but the highest cost benefit of any cleanup program ever in history.
And lastly, I mean, this is just fascinating, and we talked about the implications for society. Did any of these people who are working on this, and you outlined sort of the stories of the different people who sort of stumbled onto these findings over the years and then went out and aggressively tested this hypothesis. But do any of these people have sort of other ideas about other molecules? I mean, I wonder just sort of like, you know, there was a story I think I saw last year around this time about the implications of mercury and what it's doing to songbirds. Because it's actually now building up in the woods and in the soil in the woods in a way that we hadn't anticipated. I mean, do any of these people sort of, because it is such a revelation in some respects and has such wide-ranging implications. I wonder if you came across any other theories of things that might be the next version of this.
Oh, I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there, and no, I didn't look deeply into it, but, you know, mercury is a heavy metal, just like lead. And, you know, heavy metals in general are going to be bad news in different ways. You know, lead is bad news because of a very particular effect it has, namely that it can mimic the effect of calcium ions in the brain, and that's where it does its damage. Mercury does its damage through a different mechanism, but it's a heavy metal, too, and that means it sort of settles into your tissue and stays there and can cause pretty serious damage. You know, there's other stuff out there that, you know, we're discovering affects the endocrine system, the glandular system, in what seem like fairly serious ways, but the research is still sort of in the early stages. It's maybe where lead research was in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, I suspect we are going to find out. I mean, 20 years from now, we're going to be wondering about a lot of stuff beyond just lead. A lot of this stuff that we have in our plastics, a lot of this stuff that we have in our food, we're going to be wondering why we ever let that stuff get in there.
Well, Kevin Drum, the piece is fascinating. We have it linked on at majority.fm. Thanks so much for coming on and walking us through it. And thanks so much for writing it up, because I think it's, like I say, the implications of this are huge, and both in where we should be going in terms of public policy and what we should be looking towards for some of society's ills.
Well, thanks for having me on.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break and head into the better half of the program, the number 646-257-3920. We are flying now with the co-pilot, the pilot has passed out. And we can't revive him because he's in Vegas right now. And so we seem to be going all right. Folks, you can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. It is your support that provides 98 point. I don't know. There was a little bit of lead when I was a kid, so I can't quite do the math. But your support makes this program possible. You can also support the program by buying your coffee at justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, co-op owned, 10% coupon code with the word majority. And of course, if you buy stuff from Amazon, buy it through our link. We get a kickback. You can just go to majority.fm/support the show. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your stuff through there. You won't notice a difference, but we will. And stick around for the better half. You can IM me at Majority FM. Call me at 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, so we take one. La poupée qu'il fait non.
Fuck off.
She says no. I give her my heart. She says no. 'Cause you're only afraid to leave. Only a brother to. Ask her to walk with me. She shakes her head at me. She's a pretty little doll who says no, 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 no. All the night time through she says no. Ask her to walk with me. Why can't she ever see me? She'll say no, 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 no. She'll say no.